Welcome to a podcast of a sermon delivered at the Unitarian Society of Ridgewood in New Jersey. Our congregation is a place where you will find inspiration in the richness of diverse beliefs and the power of community. Detailed information about the Unitarian Society of Ridgewood is available on our website, uuridgewood.org.
Friends, please join me as we light our chalice using the words found printed in your order of service.
I can light it.
We light this chalice with the light of truth, the warmth of love, and the energy of action.
Well, good morning. This morning we're going to spend some time with the life and work of James Baldwin, who would have turned 95 this year. And I've been thinking lately about what we mean when we talk about someone being a prophet, because there are two different ways we tend to think about that. One is someone who can see the future, someone who can tell us the things that are coming. And there's another sense of the word prophet, which is someone who simply speaks the truth. And the thing about Baldwin, and I think the reason that in the last couple of years we have seen more and more of him in the culture, returning to popularity, is because sometimes when you speak the truth, it is as though you are seeing the future. And so the things that Baldwin said in the 1960s and 1970s have a way of speaking beyond his grave, speaking to us now in the present and on into the future. So we're going to spend some time this morning with the novel If Beale Street Could Talk, which recently was turned into a great film. The book is centered on the romance between Fanny and Tish, who have known each other since childhood and have recently become lovers as young adults. Fanny is an aspiring artist who shapes stone into sculpture and whose basement apartment in the village is an escape from his own dysfunctional family and from the white supremacy in the outside world. When he's arrested for no reason after he and Tish discover that Tish is pregnant, the rest of the novel traces the response that Tish and Tish's family and Fanny's family have to the pregnancy and to the arrest, while Fanny himself is in jail. So that is the story we are going to spend our time on this morning. Friends, please join me in a spirit of meditation and reflection. We'll start spoken at first with a few lines from If Beale Street Could Talk, and then spend a few moments in silence together. When two people love each other, when they really love each other, everything that happens between them has something of a sacramental air. They can sometimes seem to be driven very far from each other. I know of no greater torment, no more resounding void when your lover has gone. But tonight, with our vows so mysteriously menaced, and with both of us, though from different angles, placed before this fact, we were more profoundly together than we had ever been before. Take care of each other, Joseph had said. You're going to find out it's more than a notion. Good morning. I'm so happy to be back with you all again, and this time without the impending prospect of a baby being born to distract me. And I'm particularly excited to reflect with you a little bit about James Baldwin's novel, If Beale Street Could Talk. In my PhD program, I spent a lot of time with Baldwin, but I don't get to talk about Baldwin with other people as much as I would like. James Baldwin was one of the great black writers, really one of the great writers of the 20th century. As a novelist, commentator, and essayist, Baldwin received wide acclaim for his incisive analysis of white supremacy in the United States and for his fiction. But Baldwin was also one of the 20th century's great theological writers. Baldwin was raised in church, and theological questions, particularly Christian theological questions about the lingering significance of the past, the value and dangers of hope, the centrality and meaning of love, these questions drive so much of Baldwin's work. Baldwin was born and raised in Harlem, raised in a storefront church, even preached as a teenager in his church growing up, until he began to find himself more at home in the community of artists and writers in the village. Following his ambition to be a writer and feeling out of place as a gay black man in the United States in the 50s, he made his way to the large American expatriate community in France. For Baldwin, the community of same-sex loving people of many races in France, and particularly in Paris, provided an artistic community, as well as a way to escape the pinchers of white supremacy and homophobia that he encountered in his native New York. So many of his early novels reflect a sort of faith in the possibilities of particular people, of individuals, to transcend race and sex and sexuality. Race and sexuality are always present for Baldwin. But for the early Baldwin, there was a sense that there were at least some white people, teachers, friends, lovers, whose authentic connections could break through the barriers of white supremacy. By the time If Beale Street Could Talk was written, James Baldwin had lost some of that optimism. By 1973, the year the novel was published, Medgar and Malcolm and Martin were all dead. For all the problems that Baldwin had with white liberals, even some of the ones he most admired, like Robert Kennedy, were gone. But some of the themes from Baldwin's earlier work are still present in a harder, wizened form. Just as in his novels like Go Tell It on the Mountain and Giovanni's Room, it is the loss of innocence that makes it possible to deal with the world in love. What I love about If Beale Street Could Talk is that its political edge is sharper. When it was first published, the novel was critiqued, especially by white critics, for the way in which certain of its characters seemed to be stereotypes or tropes. The holy roller, the corrupt and violent cop, the feckless white liberal. Baldwin, critics said, had lost his relentless focus on the particularity of each human being. Each of his earlier characters, they said, had defied stereotypes and were irreducibly, particularly, themselves. And they claimed that Baldwin had lost that gift. But I think this underestimates Baldwin as a social critic. By making some of his characters recognizable types, Baldwin brings a broader social horizon into view. The book is centered on the romance between Fanny and Tish, who have known each other since childhood and recently, as young adults, have become lovers. Fanny aspires to be a sculptor. He shapes stone and wood, and his basement apartment is an escape from the white supremacy of the outside world. He retreats there, sometimes alone and sometimes with Tish, to do his art and to chart his own way. When Fanny is arrested for no reason by a corrupt cop, Fanny and Tish are separated just after learning that Tish is pregnant. And the rest of the novel is a response from Tish, who narrates the novel, from Tish's family, and from Fanny's family. Their response to the pregnancy, to the arrest, and to Fanny languishing in jail. Fanny's whole family, taken together, can be seen as Baldwin's metaphors for certain kinds of black politics and certain kinds of Christian religiosity. And Baldwin's critique is not subtle. Fanny's mother favors a kind of respectability politics which coldly dismisses the majority of black people as undeserving. She is rigid and unloving. When Tish becomes pregnant, his mother's response is to damn Tish and the baby, her own grandchild. "I always knew you would be the destruction of my son," she says. "You have a demon in you, and the Holy Ghost will cause that child to shrivel in your womb." Better to say that than to make any bend in her brittle morality. Most revealing of all, even in a moment of compassion toward her wayward son, she soon has herself back at the center of the story. "But my son will be forgiven," she says. "My prayers will save him. My prayers." Fanny's sisters share this rigid moral sense, but with them there is mainly hypocrisy, at least if we take Tish's accusations of their sexual promiscuity as she presents them. For the sisters, too, the world is made up of moral absolutes, so rigid and unforgiving that when they prove impossible, hypocrisy is the only solution. Fanny's father, at first glance, could not be more different from Fanny's mother and sisters. There is none of the apparent virtue, none of the religiosity, none of the holy rhetoric. He is cynical and worldly. But for him, there is no middle ground between "we're okay" and "we're screwed." Fanny's father's experience has made him, to all appearances, wise to the ways of the world. Most importantly, he articulates truths about white violence and the complicity of some blacks. Reading the novel, it almost seems like he is the good guy, the one person who gets it. He isn't rigid or hypocritical. When Fanny is arrested, his father steals to raise money for Fanny's defense. But in the extremes of his attitude, he's actually not that different from his wife and daughters. There is, for him, too, a tendency toward absolutes, a sense that things must get better, and if they don't, we can only despair. He is a certain kind of truth teller, a pragmatist, who nonetheless clings too tightly to hope and cannot bear it when it dies. And it's Fanny's father who points to one of Baldwin's preoccupations here. Beyond the broad critique of Christian religiosity and hypocrisy, there is a subtler theological question around the value and dangers of hope. And even where we manage to dodge the brittle morality that Baldwin so obviously critiques, Baldwin's critique of hope has value. After Fanny is arrested, hope looks like it may be coming in the form of Hayward, a white defense attorney who is working on Fanny's case. Since this is a novel in which each character is kind of a symbol in a parable, Hayward is representative of the white liberal, who means well and tries earnestly. And for Baldwin, the relationship between Fanny and Tish and their families and Hayward is complex, but ultimately inadequate. Hayward is convinced of the goodness of his works and even draws Tish out of her suspicion into moments of genuine connection. Baldwin knows these complex feelings well. And in the face of the corrupt cop and a false arrest, the well-meaning liberal can do some things, if slowly, and at great cost to Fanny and Tish's families. But in the end, the real prison, the prison of white supremacy in the whole world, has no bail, or at least none that any of them can afford. This is perhaps a microcosm of Baldwin's own relationship with white liberals, particularly later in his life. He is not angry with them, at least not all the time. But he is always suspicious and conscious of their limitations. He is always fully aware that the things Hayward and the white liberals he symbolizes, the things that they propose as salvation, can only free people from the prisons they can see. But there are other prisons. Everyone in this story, more or less, is imprisoned in some way, and everyone has a way of responding. Tisha's family responds differently from Fanny's family. They aren't church-going folk. They are ruckus and funny, and they party, and they curse, and they drink. But their joy is not naivete. It is a mode of survival. They are more human and more humane than Fanny's family, despite, well, because of, their drinking and moral flexibility. It gives them the ability to be absolute, not about the rules, but about each other, unconditionally defending the people around them, drawing their own circle wider to include Fanny with little hesitation. Tisha's mother's response to learning of Tisha's pregnancy is kind and shrewd. They strategize together about how to get her taken care of and what the best way is to tell the rest of the family. For Tish and her family, love again wins the day, not in the sense of ending the powers of violence and death, but in that love structures their lives. It is love, not hope, that makes this day and the next day possible. Yet the closest thing to salvation that Baldwin portrays is not the restoration of Fanny to Tish's arms, a scene which, if it happens at all, happens out of view. The novel ends without us seeing whether that ever happens. It is rather a change in Fanny, which Tish describes in terms both tragic and beautiful. On the one hand, as Tish narrates, something hardens in him. Something changes forever. His tears freeze in his belly. He has leapt from the promontory of despair. But it is also something quite strange, altogether wonderful. It is not that he gives up hope, but that he ceases clinging to it. Fanny has learned, maybe, some of the flexibility, that persistence, that his own family didn't have. Where his basement apartment had been an escape of sorts, stuck in the prison, Fanny learns some flexibility that helps him survive. Some of the things that have held Tish's own family together in their own prisons. He has had to lose his innocence to make love possible. He can live, even if it is not the life he would have chosen. It is not cheap grace. There are real costs. But it is a way of going forward. I'm reminded of Elie Wiesel's recollection that the first ones to die in the Nazi death camps were those that had hope, the ones who thought that the next day, the next week, the next month, the next Yom Kippur, their deliverance would come. And when it did not, they could not bear it, and they died. Fanny is, of course, changed, and in some ways, for the worse. Certainly, he will not be the romantic innocent that he was. When she visits him in jail, Tish notes the ways that Fanny's face bears the marks of his loss of innocence. His relationship with Stone is changed, from one in which stone represents pure artistic potentiality to one in which it represents only a prison wall. But he will have survived. Like so many survivors, he can survive only by ceasing to cling to a certain kind of hope and replacing it with something more real. The critique of hope as things getting better is present even in the structure that Baldwin gives to the story. Central plot questions are simply left unresolved. Does Fanny get released? We will never know. If knowing that is what we insist on, Baldwin leaves us unsatisfied. It is as though Baldwin is reminding his reader that in the story, as in life, plots do not wrap up cleanly, and whether things get resolved is sometimes something we can do little to confront. But if what we insist on is structuring our reaction around love, then the whole story is told. If the story is read not as the story of Fanny's arrest and absolution, but as the story of how this group of people got through, at least some of them, then the whole story is told. If the story is not the story of things getting better, but the story of how love structures their lives, then Baldwin gives us all we need. Fanny and Tish and Baldwin and we live in a world where death and violence reign. The world is filled with the dead and the living dead, whose flourishing is blunted and constrained and killed. They are still dropping like flies. The dead are always present, and sometimes the situation doesn't improve. Baldwin reminds us that hope can be its own kind of damnation if it is just about things getting better. The hope that matters is the love against all of it. The hope that matters is the persistent structuring of our lives around love. The hope that matters is the ceaseless, persevering cry to wake the dead. May it be so. Amen.
Friends, please join me in our words to extinguish our chalice, which are printed in your order of service.
We extinguish the flame, but not the light of truth, the warmth of the love, and the energy of affection, burn bright in our hearts
until we are together again.
Our closing words today are the closing words of If Beale Street Could Talk. When Tish goes into labor with her and Fanny's baby. I opened my mouth to say, I don't know what. When I opened my mouth, I couldn't catch my breath. Everything disappeared except my mother's eyes. An incredible intelligence charged the air between us. Then all I could see was Fanny. And then I screamed, and my time had come. Fanny is working on the wood, on the stone, whistling, smiling. And from far away, but coming nearer, the baby cries and 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 cries, cries like it means to wake the dead. Friends, work your wood and your stone. Whistle. Laugh. But if you find that you can't do any of those things, then cry. Cry and cry and cry and cry and cry and cry like you mean to wake the dead. Go in peace.